Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, how the federal government shutdown could affect Sullivan County residents. Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government is here to talk about what the shutdown means for food assistance, temporary aid, and local law enforcement grants, and how long the county can hold out before feeling the pinch. And with the federal government shutdown underway, who's taking the heat, and what does it mean for New York politics? The New York Public News Network's Andrew Waite breaks down the blame game and the political fallout. Plus, the latest episode of Curtain Call with Tom Candela, our theater podcast. And culture reporter Valerie Manzi has a report on how you can make DIY pinhole cameras and the magic of slow photography. That's coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Republican-led Senate is voting a fourth time today on dueling partisan stopgap bills to reopen the government. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports the bills are expected to fail again, extending the shutdown into next week.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune hopes the repeated votes will pressure Democrats to help the GOP. But if they don't, Thune warns the Trump administration could make good on plans for massive layoffs of federal workers.
Anytime you're in this situation, you have to manage a shutdown. Decisions have to be made about what to prioritize, where you're going to spend money. I expect there are going to be some decisions coming out about that. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Republicans control 53 seats in the Senate, so they need at least seven Democrats to reach a required 60-vote threshold to overcome a filibuster. But Democrats are demanding an extension of expiring Affordable Care Act subsidies, and Republicans say that will not happen as stopgap measure. Claudia Gisales, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the shutdown delayed the monthly jobs report. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
The jobs report, typically delivered on the first Friday of the month, is one of the government's most closely watched economic indicators. Analysts will have to wait a little longer, though, to find out how many jobs were added or subtracted in September and what happened to the unemployment rate. The workers at the Bureau of Labor Statistics who compile that report have been furloughed until the government shutdown ends. If the congressional stalemate drags on, it could also delay the September inflation report, which is supposed to be published in about 2 weeks. Excitement over artificial intelligence continues to drive the U.S. stock market higher. All the major stock indexes closed at record highs on Thursday. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Large protests continue in countries around the world against Israel's offensive against Hamas in Gaza. In Europe, the biggest protests have been in Italy, where labor unions have called for a national strike over the war in Gaza. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has more from the demonstration in Rome.
People in the crowd here tell me they feel this is a moment to say enough is enough. And it also marks a stark difference in opinion that the public feels compared to Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's position. Meloni heavily criticized the activists on the global Samud flotilla to Gaza, even saying that their actions could complicate a peace deal.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock reporting. Flights at Munich's airport were briefly halted last night after drones were spotted nearby. That makes Germany the latest European country to have to close its airport for nearby drone sightings. Wall Street higher at the opening bell. The Dow is now up 229 points. The Nasdaq is trading flat. The S&P 500 is up 10. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Church of England has named a woman as its top leader for the first time. Sarah Mullally is the new Archbishop of Canterbury, leading the world's 85 million Anglicans. And NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
Mullally is a 63-year-old mother of two who first trained as a nurse, then an Anglican priest, then a bishop. She also sits in the House of Lords, the upper chamber of the UK Parliament, and was the youngest person ever appointed as chief nursing officer for England. Mullally replaces Justin Welby, who resigned as archbishop after an inquiry found he failed to report child abuse at Christian summer camps. She'll lead a church divided over the consecration of women as bishops and the treatment of LGBTQ people. A group of Anglican churches in Africa and Asia has already said it rejects Mullally's appointment, saying it shows the English arm of the church has, quote, relinquished its authority to lead. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Thank you for the lovely bouquet. I'm married to the hustle and
singer-songwriter Taylor Swift dropped her 12th studio album at midnight called The Life of a Showgirl. This is the title track of that same name. There are 12 tracks on the album, and fans will get a chance to attend release parties around the country this weekend after Swift announced AMC Theaters will premiere her video for The Fate of Ophelia, along with behind-the-scenes video and explanations of the inspirations for her songs. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. It's Friday, and Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government with the latest news from Monticello. But there was no meeting yesterday of the legislature because of Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
However, some news that's making national headlines, as we heard from NPR News, the government shutdown is impacting or could impact locally Sullivan County government and Sullivan County residents. What can you tell us about the impact so far of this three-day federal government shutdown?
Well, so far it looks like, as is the case, because we've gone through shutdowns before, that if it's the first few days of it, nothing too much too bad. It's more the worrying and the anxiety part of it all, which you know as well as I do when it comes to government funding. So in this case, though, we're thinking that probably what the biggest impact is going to be is the grants, that we may not get them as timely as we do, or there may be some reporting that we have to do that's not necessarily read or acted upon as quickly as we need to. We're not there yet, but what our departments have told me, for example, Health and Human Services have said SNAP will continue as normal for the current month. Same for temporary assistance, which is basically what a lot of people would know as welfare. And
SNAP is the food assistance.
All of that is the stuff to help people out when they really can't help themselves on these things. It's the stuff that a lot of people at Sullivan County rely on, and we want to be able to give that to them. So far that's all continuing. I think if it were to stretch out farther with the federal government, the state would step in and help us make sure that that's maintained as well. So not too worried about that, but we're keeping a wary eye on it. We're not able to submit our quarterly federal financial report for a grant to the Department of Justice, but that deadline isn't until October 30th. So we like to work earlier rather than later.
Talk about what that is for folks who may not know what these quarterly reports are.
These are for grants that we get for law enforcement, and with every grant, we have to keep track of how we're spending it, what we're doing with it. We are a high intensity drug trafficking area. We got that a couple years ago through Senator Schumer. And so we have to make sure that we are telling the government we're being responsible with their money and we're doing what we need to do. But when the portal can't necessarily be accessed, or the people on the other side are furloughed
because
so they don't have
down.
Time
yeah,
to read it, then that money can't just continue to flow. I talked with our planning division this morning. They said so far so good, but their concern also is on the grant side of things. Will that money continue to flow? So far, the federal government has said yes, it will. But the longer this goes on, the more politically heated it gets, the more concerned we are that how do I put this? That we could get lost in the mix of the debate.
It's only 3 days old, and according to the New York Times this morning, the Senate is set to reconvene today to vote on whether to take up the dueling proposals to reopen the government, but neither was expected to win bipartisan backing needed to end the shutdown. And it seems as if, well, at least from rhetoric on both sides here, you're not looking for, you don't see, I don't have a lot of confidence. That's from my personal opinion. But from a government perspective, like, how long can the county go before you start feeling the pinch?
Well, my folks have told me that in another month or two, if this continues, that's when we're going to start feeling some impacts from it. How much also depends, like I said, about how the state can fill in for certain things. But we can't exceed our budget necessarily for what we have because we have a new budget starting in 2026, but right now we're in the 2025 budget. So it could get a little hairy towards the end of the year if this were to drag on for that long. And I definitely, if it continues to drag on, we'll probably be in here almost every week talking about the impacts of that. So I hope not to, but if so, your listeners should know what's going on.
Aside from the SNAP benefits or temporary assistant benefits that, you know, so far are okay, are there any other programs or benefits that listeners, residents should know about? Or is there anything that they should just pay attention to or be aware of?
Like I said, pay attention to the news.
Yeah.
Like what you have here at JFF. Pay attention to what JFF's putting out about that, because you guys are paying close attention to it. Talk with your federal representative offices. They actually love voter feedback, especially on issues like this. Schumer and Gillibrand's office would love to hear it. Riley's office. It's at the federal level that you want to be paying attention. But there's nothing really more beyond that to be done at this point. It's up to our elected representatives to bridge this gap.
Let's talk about some other things going on. The Tuesday, an in-house hiring event. Tell us about the folks that are going to be there and what folks need to know in terms of if they're out looking for a job.
Yeah, this is a great thing that our Center for Workforce Development does almost every week now, it feels like. Tuesday, October 7th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at our Career Center, which is just east, I guess. Is that the word? Yeah, east of the Government Center, 50 North Street in Monticello. We're going to have BOCES there. We're going to have Cartwright there, our indoor water park. We're going to have Thompson Sanitation there from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., ready to talk with people and possibly even hire them right on the spot. Sullivan County, we are fortunate. We continue to have more jobs than we have people to fill them. Our unemployment rate continues to be one of the lowest in the state, and our job growth rate has continued to be in the top 10. That's leveling off, but there are still jobs out there. Like BOCES says, a teacher assistant. Most anyone can probably qualify for that as long as they can pass a background check. A teacher aide, a substitute cleaner, a substitute typist, a substitute food service helper. Cartwright's looking for bartenders, cooks, public area attendants, but they're also looking for accountants and payroll coordinators. Thompson Sanitation Corporation is looking for CDL and non-CDL drivers. You don't have to have a commercial driver's license. They're also looking, I don't know what this means, but for helpers. I don't know if that's like you get to ride the back of the garbage truck. That actually, I'm going to sound weird here, but that always sounded fascinating to me. Like, you get to ride on the outside of the vehicle? I know you're dealing with stinky garbage, but as a kid, I always thought that fascinating. So, anyway, I'm sorry, I've embarrassed myself now. Anyway, but this is a great event.
Do folks need to, what do they need to know about the event in terms of like what they should bring or what they should do?
Bring a resume if you have it. Dress nicely. You don't have to dress to the nines kind of thing. You don't have to have a suit and tie or a floor-length evening gown on kind of thing. Although, I guess you could if you want to stand out in the crowd. So,
now I'm picturing someone in a floor-length evening gown on the back of a pickup, of
a garbage truck, yeah. Right? I think that'd be awesome, wouldn't you?
Let's just make it more glamorous. If you're just joining us, it's Dan Hoost, who we seem to have lost for a moment.
I've gone off the rails here. Oh, gosh.
He's our communications director from Sullivan County Government, telling us about what's going on in Monticello. There's that Career Center in-house hiring event in Monticello Tuesday from 11 to 2. And again, employers ready to hire on the spot. Again, we've been talking about this all summer long, really. The rabies cases that were here. There's another rabies clinic coming up in the town of Thompson in Monticello. That is coming up on the 8th. That is Wednesday. I can't believe it's October.
Yeah, I can't believe either. So I saw that. I was like, is it that a little farther down? But no,
nope.
It's coming up on October 8th, 6 to 7:30 p.m. We continue to get great turnout at these rabies events. I think I heard something like we had 90 people at the last one or something with all their pets. listen, if your pet hasn't gotten vaccinated or hasn't been vaccinated in 3 or more years, it's time to come do this. It's a great service. It's free. You don't have to pre-register. You only have to show that you're a Sullivan County resident anywhere in Sullivan County. Just because we're having it in the town of Thompson at the Monticello Firehouse from 6 to 7:30 doesn't mean you have to be from Monticello. You could be from Fremont. You could be from Bloomingburg, Grahamsville, Narrowsburg. Come.
And that is on a Wednesday the 8th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Mm-hmm. There's a guided history walk along the D&H Canal and O&W Railroad Path coming up next weekend.
Yeah, this is cool. They already did one of these, and I heard it was very good, and I'm sorry I missed it. I'm hoping to get to this one. But Karen Barnes, who is this guy that is full of history down in the town of Mamikating, he knows all sorts of things about the Delaware and Hudson Canal and the Ontario and Western Railway. I bet he could also tell you about the fact that the Wurtsboro Airport is the oldest still active place for soaring for gliders in the nation. He could probably tell you about the old Newburgh and Coshecton Turnpike that ran through town, the old mine road that ran through town, which is considered one of the oldest improved roads in America. Mamikating is chock full of this kind of fascinating history. Can you tell I like it? And so he is going to be doing a walk at 10 a.m. on the 11th. I almost said at 11 a.m. on the 10th. No, October 11th, 10 a.m., he's going to be starting out at our interpretive center in Summitville, which itself is a fascinating place. This is an easy level walk. It is accessible as well. If you want to bring somebody who might be in a wheelchair or scooter kind of thing, it can handle that as well. And you're going to learn things you never knew about the county. I bet people don't even realize the county's oldest cemetery is on the grounds of the Wurtsboro Airport. Oh. With a grave dating back to the
1700s. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Oh. Good for spooky season.
Yes.
Also, a public hearing and annual senior resource fair coming up on October 15th.
Yes, and this is going to be the first county event held at the new airport terminal. They got a tour of it and said, oh, we want to show off this beautiful terminal that is about to open. In fact, we hope to have shortly before that a grand opening ceremony with the state, but I don't have the full details of that yet. I will let you know as soon as we do. But October 15th, starting at 10 a.m., the Office for the Aging, by law, has to have an annual public hearing for the public to know what we're doing, what we plan to do, and also for the public to tell us what they'd like us to be doing. And trust me, our seniors, our older adults in Sullivan County, they're good about telling us what to do. We want them, though, to come and speak up at this as well. Don't just wait to talk to us on the phone. You'll have a good time. There's refreshments that will be served. And after the public hearing, we have a senior resource fair that will take up the rest of the terminal where you can learn all sorts of interesting things about not only the programs and services we offer at the county, but the programs and services all our partners offer. And I've been learning some things with my mom recently, who is an older adult, that I didn't know we had in the county. And me, like, of all people.
Like what?
Well, she was able to get, for example, the cooling benefit from HEAP over the summer. She was also able to get some orthopedic equipment that we had in reserve. And also, one of my family members who cares for her is eligible to be reimbursed or paid, I'm not sure what it's called, by the state through a program that they have to pay caregivers so that she can actually get some money for doing what we all used to just have to do for free. So these kinds of things we learned through the Office for the Aging and its partners. They can't wait to tell you about the stuff that you may be eligible for that you had no idea about. So it is worth the time, and you're going to get to see a brand new building before virtually anybody else.
And the government center there in Monticello is turning 50 this month.
Yes. I get a chance today. Later today, I'm going to take a picture of the recently shined up cornerstone of the government center, which I didn't realize was removed from the building when we put in different entrances and exits for the government center. And it's been stored very carefully. I'm going to take a picture of that. I also have some old pictures of what the government center looked when it was brand new. It opened officially in October of 1975. Some interesting things I'm hoping to find in the photos that people may not have realized is the original front entrance off of North Street was steps. non-accessible, non-ADA compliant, but it was before the ADA. But the steps also surrounded a beautiful fountain that used to exist there that doesn't anymore. So it's sort of cool. This building has served us very well. It was built to be, interior modular, I guess, where not a lot of walls inside are load-bearing, and so we can move offices around. So the configuration of it has changed a lot over the past 50 years, but it still is sort of the beating heart of county government. It is the center, the lobby, the hearing room all sort of look like they did. That lobby floor has amazingly lasted for 50 years with very little damage. I wish my floor would last that long for just 10 years, but it's a building that most everyone in Sullivan County, if you've been here for any length of time, has been in, and it's got a happy birthday this month.
Is there any significance to the design or the designer? Or do you know? It has that appearance of like a brutalist architecture.
Yeah, kind of feel. It was the brutalist architecture towards the end of the brutalist architecture period. It was a Milton Levine Associates. I thought it was the same architect that did the college, because if you notice, the college has similar architecture, has sort of those vertical windows set into the concrete. But the college was a different, much more famous designer. They have an interesting history. But the Government Center was part of what I call the decade of big building for Sullivan County. Started with the airport opening in 69, then came Grover Herman Hospital in Calicoon in 71, then came SUNY Sullivan in 73, then the Government Center in 75, and then it rounded out with what was then known as Community General Hospital in Harris in 77. That decade had a whole bunch of major public works projects that went on.
I never thought of them collectively like that, but yes.
Yeah, it was quite the building period in Sullivan.
Think about them all.
Something we've never seen since, not on that scale.
All right, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. Again, there was no meeting yesterday of the legislature because of Yom Kippur, but next week we'll bring us some more info every Friday.
I should be more interesting next week.
Dan Hoost, thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the government shutdown and how it is infecting New York politics. That's next after this break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
And I'm Dwayne Brown.
We normally bring you the NPR newscast each hour, but today we're here with something different.
That's right. We're sharing some recent NPR donor comments from listeners all across the country, like William in Arizona. He donated because the truth matters. I couldn't have said it better myself, William.
Anita in Maryland says, free and fair news is important for me and those in my diverse community to thrive and understand one another.
Biora in Florida donated to support, quote, dependable, informative, brave reporting. I could go on and on.
Okay, we'll end with Joe in Kentucky, who says, I can't imagine a world without public radio.
If you can't imagine a world without public radio either, please join the community of NPR network supporters and give to this station today.
Here's how, and thank you.
Make your donation at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. With the federal government shutdown in day three, the finger pointing has begun. The New York Public News Network's Andrew Waite discussed the blame game as well as the shutdown's potential influence on New York politics with Siena University political science professor Len Cutler.
Republicans, of course, control both houses of Congress as well as the administration. So you would think, logically, of course, since the Senate is controlled by the Republicans and John Thune, and the House is controlled by Mike Johnson and the Republicans, and of course the White House is President Trump, that all the blame should be going to the Republicans. That would be a general assumption, given that the party in power is the party that controls legislation and decision making. However, we are so sharply partisanly divided, Andrew, as a nation, that if I saw an SRI poll, you know, the most recent poll, I would think it's going to come down both ways. I think Democrats are hoping that they can point the finger of blame at the Republicans. I don't know if it's going to stick. I really don't feel comfortable saying that it's indeed the party in power that's going to take the hit on this one. We can guess whatever we want to guess, but looking at how deeply divided this nation is in terms of its support, DNR, and how partisan that divide is, I think the loyalists for the Democrats and loyalists of Republicans are going to say it's the other party's fault.
Does the length of the shutdown ultimately determine how people feel about it and where they place the blame the longer it goes on?
Well, usually that, yeah, of course. I mean, what we're going to see, we're looking at discretionary spending, okay? 60% of all spending is mandatory. So if you're looking at the entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, they're going to be protected. So those individuals, Andrew, that are receiving such aid are very definitely not going to be adversely impacted. However, with respect to those who are relying upon discretionary funding, that's where the rubber is going to hit the road, because it's going to go after public health. It's going to go after farm loans. It's going to go after transportation funding and income support to help lower income individuals. Additionally, the longer this drags on, and as you may recall, the last such occasion we have was in 2018-19, and that lasted 35 days. Mm-hmm. And now you may say, well, 35 days, that's not too long. Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is, in terms of anything past the 8 to 10-day max cycle that we've seen as a regular rule in the past, then it becomes more troublesome.
Yeah.
What happens with air traffic controllers who ain't getting paid? Are they going to walk off the job? I mean, vital individuals, you know, law enforcement and military and air traffic controllers, et cetera, they're supposed to just swallow and wait until the agreement occurs. And that agreement could drag out for several weeks.
Yeah.
So if you have that kind of impact, then very well, air traffic transportation could be disrupted severely. All contracts are on hold. No contracts can be issued.
Right.
Contractors are not getting paid. So you're looking at usually we're in the range of $180 to $190 billion, not million, billion dollars in contracts annually. And 28% of it is coming through something like the Small Business Administration. Small Business Administration is going to be shut down, Andrew. So you don't have paychecks. This is where the you see the domino effect, okay? Those who are directly affected aren't going to be spending money. So what happens? The economy is going to feel the brunt of it. And small businesses may be those that take the most disproportionate hit.
Yeah.
That's where the time frame comes in that could be very troublesome and problematic for the nation.
And I wanted to turn this...
You're saying, well, who would get the blame with respect to that occurring? Andrew, I still think, even if that occurs over a period of time and people are really hurting, you're going to have the same fingers pointing at the Republicans and the same fingers pointing at the Democrats.
How about for New York politics specifically? I mean, obviously the big race that everyone's watching for this election is the New York City mayoral race.
Yep.
Do you think that there will be any side more likely to bring up a shutdown? I mean, is this something, does this in any way benefit Andrew Cuomo running as an independent? Is it something Zohran Mamdani running with the Democratic backing would bring up?
Well, I think Mamdani certainly he's been consistent in terms of his statements and his positions vis-a-vis the Republican administration in Washington. We certainly know where President Trump stands with respect to Mamdani. Andrew Cuomo now has an opportunity, given the fact that Eric Adams has withdrawn from the race, pull some of his support for November. But again, the two candidates, the two principal candidates, I know Curtis Sliwa is the Republican candidate, right. But the two principal candidates here, Cuomo and Mamdani, I think are going to pretty much take a similar position vis-a-vis the shutdown in Washington.
Right.
I don't expect
a dysfunctional Washington
to speak at cross purposes as far as that's concerned.
Do you think there are any implications for the 2026 gubernatorial race, which obviously is not even totally set, but we know that Governor Kathy Hochul is seeking re-election as a Democrat. It's likely that Congresswoman Elise Stefanik is going to challenge her as a Republican. Will this shutdown be talked about for that midterm and gubernatorial election?
You know, I'm not convinced that that's going to be a principle. It'll come up very definitely by both the incumbent and the challenger. And I'm not positive that Elise Stefanik is going to run. I know that she is considered the most viable Republican at this point, and she's certainly made indications or provided indications that she's seriously considering running. But I don't know whether or not she is, at the end of the day, Andrew, going to be the big R candidate for this gubernatorial election in 2026. Will the shutdown factor in? Sure. Hochul's going to use the shutdown. And again, it'll be Democrat blaming the Republicans and the Democrat governor blaming the Republican House and Senate leadership and the president. And the trickle-down effect impacting upon New Yorkers in need of vital services that are unavailable to them because the agencies in question are shut down, like Health and Human Services, like U.S. Department of Education, like DOT. And we can go on and on, because Russ Vogt from OMB is already preparing the furloughing lists with support from the cabinet officials as to who's going to be let go. And furthermore, there's a very real concern that furloughing may lead very well to firing. And that we didn't have in 2018-19. This time around, there are threats that federal employees will not be coming back to work. And that was placed on Schumer and Jeffrey's shoulders. So the Republicans are blaming the Democratic leadership for, in fact, allowing the federal workforce to be diminished, to be riffed. We'll see how that plays out, because that could impact on the 2026 vital congressional elections.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think what would it take for the divide to not be roughly 50-50? Is there an issue that could break that you could see it moving more toward 60-40, or are we just stuck forever here in this 50-50 divide?
For the short term, I think we're stuck.
Yeah.
So there isn't one issue that's going to, in fact, separate that divide. Not at the moment.
Len Cutler, PhD, professor of political science and director of the pre-law program at Siena University. Dr. Cutler, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome, Andrew. My pleasure.
And thanks to Andrew Waite of the New York Public News Network for that report. We'll take a break. And when we come back, it's the latest episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast. Tom Candela is here with a preview next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar. This week on Farming Country, farmers' mental health have taken a toll. Genevieve Hartnett chatted with farmers to learn how the industry is navigating the rise in tariffs, federal budget cuts, and the fear of ICE raids on local farms.
They can't do it anymore because they have to take care of their mental health and wellness.
Catch us this week on Farming Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Friday, the new episode of our podcast focused on theater, Curtain Call, drops, and we get a preview from its host and producer, Tom Candela, who is here this Friday.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about what's coming up and also what you're working on.
Yeah.
This episode is about River Rep and some of the stuff they've got coming up. Tell us.
Correct. Well, so River Rep, of course, well-known theater company here in our community. They are bringing back, there's a couple of things we talked about. They are bringing back The Never-Ending Story, which was a big hit.
That was a big summer thing.
Yeah, a big summer hit, and it's coming back in December. So that's good news there. We also talk a little bit about their River Rep Junior program, which started last week on the 27th and will continue every Saturday for the next 10 weeks. But the main focus is going to be on the show that opens this weekend, Christopher Durang's Tony Award winning comedy, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. So I sat down with Arthur Alisi, who is the co-artistic director of the company, along with Christopher Perdido, the other artistic director. And we talked about the show. We talked about the River Rep in general. We talked about what's coming up in the future for them.
And coming up in the future, speaking of that, you've got a really exciting episode coming up next week.
Next week?
Can you tease a little bit of that?
Next week, yes, I'm going to tease that. I sat down, or I should say I spoke with Austin Pendleton and Bradford Cover. Now, many people know who Austin Pendleton are. Not only is he a big theater name, but he's movies and television, and he's been around for decades. And they have a company in New York City called the Resident Acting Company, and they're putting on a new production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. So I got to sit down with both of them and talk to them about that production, which is going to be coming up. That opens up soon in the next coming few weeks.
So we're going to preview that next week.
Correct. That'll be our next week's show.
This week we're talking to Arthur at River Rep. And so this is a clip of the latest episode of Curtain Call.
Yes.
You can hear the full episode at our website dropping today.
Today.
WJFFradio.org. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Today we are featuring Arthur Alisi from the River Rep Theater, and he's one of the artistic directors. He's also performs in their shows. I don't know if he's directing yet.
I have.
He has directing as well. So he plays a big part in our theater community. Ambitious, imaginative storytelling, and they're also committed to educating young people as well. We're going to talk about their new exciting production of Christopher Durang's Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. So, Arthur, welcome once again.
Thank you, Tom.
Curtain Call.
Great to see you as always, and thanks for having us back.
Oh, absolutely. It's so exciting. So let's go back to The Never-Ending Story. It was a big production, and it was
our biggest, yes.
It was your biggest. I mean, you had about 11
people.
11 mm-hmm. people in the show. It involved a lot of staging. You had a trap door in the stage and a lot of fantastical lighting and sound and a lot of fun. Tell us a little bit about how that came together.
Chris had done the play in Sarajevo when he lived abroad.
Right. We're talking Chris Perdido, who's not here today, is the co-artistic director of River Rep.
He sent me the script to take a look at, and I immediately fell in love with it. I read it, and I thought, wow, this could be an amazing, magical stage production on Broadway if you had $18 million. If you had $1,800, you could do an equally amazing, magical production on the stage of the Delaware Valley Opera Center.
Right, and I think you did a great job because you filled that stage with the scenery, and the costumes were fantastic. I mean, they really were.
Yeah, we had three wonderful women doing the costumes, Liz Huntington, Eileen Augustin, and Beth Vries. There were over 30 costumes for the 11 actors, and they all shined wonderfully.
And they were very detailed costumes.
Yeah,
I mean,
great.
There were people playing animals and dragons and all sorts of things. So there was a lot involved. There's quite a few quick costume changes, too.
Yes, there were. Yeah, it was organized chaos backstage, for sure.
So can you share a little behind-the-scenes story about how all those elements did come together?
We had an amazing cast of people. It was really an amazing ensemble of artists, from the costumers to the actors to the everyone was really excited to be working on it, and everyone just gave, and it was magical. So, because the play was such a hit. And because as a repertory company, we want to keep plays alive and bring them to other parts of the county or state even, we're doing Never Ending Story again in December
for a
weekend. December 5th, 6th, 7th. It will be at Delaware Valley Opera Center in Lake Huntington. We are also in talks with other venues to move it around. Chris is in talks with the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center in serious talks.
So Jonathan, he called your show, and we have to say this because it was so good, a knock your socks off over the top presentation.
I was very proud of that. I mean, I think, again, like I said, it was a labor of love for everyone. Everybody put so much of their heart and soul into this, and the kids loved it, and I think adults as well, and it just felt good. I spoke at our closing performance party, and I'm welling up thinking about it now. It was just a really lovely experience, and I love all those people.
That's great. I want to talk a little bit now about how you're cultivating the next generation of performers. One of your goals has been to bring in young people as a way of educating and getting them away from their phones, getting them away from their laptops and the social media, and getting them out there and being with each other and learning how to communicate through theater. So tell us a little bit about the goals behind the program and about this River Rep Junior.
Well, we've been talking about wanting to start a program for young kids interested in theater or in performance. Primarily, it will be an acting workshop.
Okay.
We, of course, believe that the skills they learn are going to serve them far beyond the stage. Communication skills, being able to express an opinion, being able to hear others, being able to work together toward a goal. These are life goals that are hugely important. And they are at the basis of good acting, I think. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be something for everyone.
So folks who are interested, if you've already missed the deadline for becoming a member this time around, you can audit a class or one of the groups. It happens on Saturday. Talk a little bit about that and how that would work.
Well, we're hoping that this is going to be an ongoing thing.
Mm-hmm.
This fall, we're focusing on basics, objectives, obstacles, actions, being open.
Listening,
getting your... finding your voice, being comfortable on stage, all that. And then we'll work on some scenes. We'll do text analysis and we'll pick scenes that are appropriate for the levels that the kids are at and their age and all that. And it will end in as Susan Mendoza likes to say, a share case.
Ah, a share case.
As opposed to a showcase for friends and family. The spring section we'll take whoever wants to return from the fall section and we'll focus on a production. This is the idea that we're working with now. So if it's something you're interested in, but you've missed the deadline or you didn't know about it or you couldn't do it this time around, but you want to find out what it's all about, I would encourage people to stop by and audit a class just to see what it is we're doing, see if it's something you're interested in. It's Saturdays from 11 to 1 at the Delaware Valley Opera Center.
How do you see the young artists themselves shaping the future of River Rep?
It's a great question. First of all, if we stick to our plan at the moment where the fall session will be more training, the spring session will be more production, that would be opened up to the public, perhaps, not just friends and family. And maybe that's a way to get their friends and more younger people into the theater to see what it can be, to see how enjoyable it can be.
Yeah.
There are so many initiatives that River Rep wants to start, but to have a youth component to the company that can start to do its own thing under guidance, of course, because where we actually have an ensemble of young actors who put on shows.
Put on their own shows, yeah, own productions. Yeah. So that's for the future. That's a it's a great goals that you have. So let's talk about Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. It's a Christopher Durang play. And yes, it shares some names of some of the characters that we find in some very famous Chekhov plays. But Durang says, my play is not a Chekhov parody. I take Chekhov scenes and characters and put them into a blender. What does that mean to you guys?
Well, that means that he's taking elements, but it's not... You don't need to know Chekhov to see this play.
Right. That's an important point to mention, that you don't need to see it. It's not a Chekhov play.
It's not a Chekhov play. We will have some dramaturgical material as people walk in about Chekhov. But the caveat to that is you don't need to know any of this. Here's some information for you. Forget about it. Have fun. Because that's what it is. There are Chekhov dealt with many specific themes. Unrealized dreams, unrequited love, things that are dealt with in a lot of plays, but he dealt with them in a very mundane way. Christopher Durang has taken some of those themes and put them into a modern day comedy where some of the characters, the siblings happen to have been named by their parents after Chekhov plays. Right. That is the main connection. For those who are really familiar with Chekhov, there are little Easter eggs dropped
that you're gonna
throughout
see.
It,
yeah.
But you, it is not, you don't need to know Chekhov
right.
to enjoy this play. This play is a funny, funny play about this family kind of that's stuck. It's a very funny play.
It is very funny. And just reading it, I was laughing out loud at some of the lines and some of the things that goes on in it.
I mean, hopefully will spark some conversation or at least a thought about these themes after you finish laughing. I mean, this is why this play is perfect. It's funny. It's got those levels underneath it that are serious on a very human level and on a political level as well. But it's all being done through this.
Through comedy and parody. Vanya and Sonia, Masha and Spike, coming to the theater starting on October 4th. And that's going to be the 4th and 11th at 8 p.m., the 5th and the 12th at 2 p.m. So it's two weekends, Saturdays at 8, Sundays at the 2 p.m. matinee at the Delaware Valley Opera Center in Lake Huntington, New York. How do we get tickets?
You can go to myrivertickets.com or riverrep.org.
Okay. And also going to their website, riverrep.org, you can also sign up for their newsletter, which is important because that'll keep you up to date of not only when these shows are, but also what else is happening within that River Rep community. Arthur, I want to thank you again for coming in, spending time with me here for Curtain Call.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, Tom Candela and Curtain Call, the latest episode is out today, and you can hear all the episodes of the podcast about theater on our website, wjffradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, how two soda cans and a little tape can turn into a camera. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi tells us more about a hands-on workshop coming up. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Science Friday, we'll meet a groundbreaking scientist who pioneered ocean research in Sri Lanka. Plus, understanding the science of SSRI withdrawal and why it continues to be a subject of hot debate among physicians and patients.
What I would say is that the available data is not methodologically strong enough that there's a consensus in the field.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
2 to 4 p.m. today on Radio Catskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Adam Burke had questions about AI allowing pets to testify in court.
Will they allow hostile witnesses? And by hostile witnesses, I mean cats.
I'm Nagin Farsad, in for Peter Sagal. The government shut down this week, but lucky for us, we're used to operating without federal funding. So join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Photographer Mark Burnham is bringing historical technique into the present with a hands-on workshop at Headwaters Arts Center in Stamford, New York. Participants will build pinhole cameras from aluminum cans, paper, and tape, exploring what Burnham calls the intersection of light, time, and vision. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Mark Burnham about his unique approach.
Good morning, Mark Burnham, and welcome to Radio Catskill.
Good morning, Valerie. Thank you.
Well, I've been looking forward to speaking with you because we were unable to speak before your last workshop, which was on wet plate photography, which is a very fascinating process. But happy that we're going to make it in time for your pinhole photography workshop that is coming up on October 4th. That's a Saturday, 11 to 2 at Headwaters Art Center in Stamford, and that's under the arm of the Roxbury Arts Group. And I'm going to crib an opening line here because it's a good one. Ever wondered what the sun would paint if you gave it a few days or weeks instead of just a fraction of a second? Can you tell us?
Well, it will give you a very cool stripe in the sky, or multiple stripes in the sky, depending. It'll give you one stripe for every day that you leave the camera out. So you can have one day, or you can have, people have done it up to 6 months. I've never done it that long.
How long have you done it for?
Probably a couple weeks.
And what did you find?
So it's a pinhole camera, right?
Yes.
We can talk about that a little bit. But basically what you get is a sort of surreal looking, removed from reality image of wherever your camera is pointing. So I pointed it usually at my house. And then you'll see this amazing arc that gets written in the sky by the sun.
It's beautiful. The photograph is very beautiful.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. It's fun because it's a very minimal, there's very little equipment involved. All you need is a couple of beer cans, some gaffer's tape, or some kind of good tape that you can, that you like, you know, that can be removed, and some photographic paper, and that's it. And it doesn't require any chemical processing, unlike wet plate, and that's it. It's fun, and you get really cool. I love when you get images that don't look like reality. I think reality sometimes is boring.
It can be, or it can be very interesting. It depends.
Exactly. But these images that you get are they're very simple to make. And that's why, one of the reasons that I think is fun. Sometimes when you do photographic endeavors, you get sort of weighed down by the amount of equipment and chemicals, et cetera. But this is very simple. All you need is, as I said, some beer cans, and then go out and hang your camera up somewhere. And usually you can tape it up to some kind of vertical surface, like a pole or something, and leave it out for as long as you want. And then when you pull the paper out, you'll have an image, hopefully.
Well, now when you say your camera, you're referring to the pinhole camera.
Yes.
What other ways can a pinhole camera be made?
Oh, many, many, many ways. So you mentioned in our pre-talk the camera obscura. So that's sort of the original version of a pinhole camera, where you have a hole in a surface and you can have an image projected from the light outside of the hole and onto a surface inside of whatever that is. It could be a room. It could be any sort of box. So you can make pinhole cameras out of all kinds of stuff, like basically any kind of box or any kind of container could be made into a pinhole camera.
And can you tell us what you will be covering in this workshop?
So in the workshop, I'm going to talk a tiny bit about the history, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how the physics of it work. And then basically, I'm just going to really focus almost like a cookbook on how you make the camera. To me, the exciting thing about this, again, is that you can make a camera out of some beer cans. Or they don't have to be beer cans. I shouldn't say that. They could be any tall. I like to use the tall cans, like you can get iced tea tall cans, because the paper that I'm using is 5x7. So you have to have a fairly long can to use that.
And folks that are taking the course, they'll be able to go home with a pinhole camera?
That's right, yep.
And instructions of what to do with it?
That's right, yep.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun.
I think in terms of the bang for the buck, it's pretty high.
Yeah.
And bang for the effort or whatever, you know, it's very high. I personally think the images are fun, and it's just not that hard to make them.
Now, you mentioned a little bit about the history and the physics. Could you share a little bit of that with our listeners today?
Sure. So the thing that I was mentioning before, so there's this basic property of light that if you shine light through a very small hole, it will tend to, and you put some sort of surface behind the hole, it will tend to be in focus at any distance from the camera. And that's because there's very few light rays that come through the hole because of their restriction. And so they tend to not scatter or arrive at different places on the paper. And that's the same principle if you've ever done any kind of regular photography. When you close the lens down to a smaller f-stop, then things are more in focus. But with a pinhole camera, the hole is very, very tiny. So it tends to have a lot of the image in focus. So that's another thing that I think is really fun. The lack of having to focus the camera, I just think is amazing. When I use large format cameras, you have to be very, very careful about how to focus everything. So it's kind of a joy for me to not have to focus anything. So the camera obscura, I think, was invented in the 1700s. I'm not super up on the history of that. I've seen a few interesting camera obscuras. If you ever have the chance to see one, I highly recommend it. I remember seeing one. There's one in San Francisco on the ocean, on the wharf, I think it's called. And it's fun because the camera is basically, it looks like a small observatory. And you stand inside the dome of it, and you can see the image reflected through the camera. And you can move it around. So you can see the ocean, you can see the ocean waves and birds flying around and all that. It's a kind of a magical experience. And we're not going to have any kind of motion. well, we will have sort of like perceived motion because the sun will have moved across the face of the paper. But you can actually set up a camera obscura. And I talked to the Roxbury Arts Group about doing this, but it would have been slightly involved, where you could hang some kind of a screen behind a window and then black out the window and then put a hole in it. And if there's enough light, you'll be able to see the image projected onto the screen.
Oh, put a hole in the window?
Put a hole in whatever's blacking out the window.
Okay.
So everything's black, and then you have a hole in the middle of the window, and then that's basically the principle of a camera obscura.
So it's all about light.
It's all about light, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a wonderful workshop, and let's remind our listeners that it's Saturday, October 4th, from 11 to 2 at Headwaters Art Center in Stamford, New York. And you are Mark Burnham, a lifelong photography enthusiast.
That's right.
You have a lot to share.
Well, I think it's going to be fun. That's the main point.
We all need more fun.
100%. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you, Mark, for taking the time to talk to us, and have fun.
Well, thank you so much for having me. That was very enjoyable.
And thanks, Valerie, for that. And that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, NACL.org, and from listeners like you.
I'm Janice Adams. Starting Monday, October 6th, join me on my new day and new time, Monday evenings at 8, for The Janice Adams Show. Crucial conversations about race, every race, and courage. The courage to listen, to speak up, to make a way out of no way. The Janice Adams Show, Monday nights at 8, starting October 6th on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Drought conditions persist throughout the region, mostly sunny today with a high of 68. There is a statewide burn ban now in effect in New York through October 15th because of these dry conditions. It will be sunny, dry, and warm through Tuesday with sunshine and highs in the mid to